Hello, everyone. Appreciate you taking the time. I'm Mark Knutson, Chief Experience Officer at CINSE. And today, our guest at CINSE Spotlight is National Association for Home Care and Hospice President Bill Dombey. Delighted for him to take the time to be with us today. For just a little bit of background, in addition to being the president of NOC, he also serves as the executive director for Home Health Financial Managers Association. And in his responsibilities, he specializes in legal, legislative, and regulatory advocacy on behalf of patients and providers of home health and hospice care. So over nearly 40 years of experience, he's been involved in virtually all legislative and regulatory efforts affecting home care and hospice, going all the way back to 1975. So brings a wealth of experience for us today. We're really pleased that he's taking the time to be with us. Just a little bit of housekeeping for everybody. Today's virtual event is being recorded, and the recording link will be sent to all attendees and registrants later this week. Also, just to be aware, all participants are muted. So if you have a question, we invite you to use the Q&A tool within the webinar platform. And we'll save some time at the end for answering any questions that you may have raised during the conversation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Bill. Look forward to hearing your thoughts on delivering home care within the context of the pandemic, as well as some of the things that we should be on the outlook for in 2021.
Thank you, Mark, and thanks to CINSE for putting this program together. Really appreciate the opportunity to spend a little time with all of you. Today is going to be a combination of reflection and crystal ball work on my part. You know, we're going to cover a number of topics from to kind of paint a context here, you know, because that context is driving the outlook for 2020. So I'll be covering, you know, where we were prior to COVID briefly, and then break the COVID era up into a couple of different components, because there has been some action differences between the first part and where we may be all the way up till today. And that'll trigger then the outlook and the Washington scene, particular part of it, what we expect from the new administration and a new Congress. And, you know, if you do have questions, feel free, I guess, to use the chat approach to that, and we'll entertain as many of those as we can. I have a tendency to absorb all the airtime, so hopefully we'll be able to get to that. I've got myself with my timers in several different directions, so I can keep myself on track. Now, I want to welcome you to my home. This is my home office. The NAC staff have essentially been working remotely since the beginning of March, and we believe we've really worked quite effectively, as many of you also have probably done the same thing. So COVID has affected every element of everyone's life in this country. It has certainly had an effect on home care and hospice, both services as well as policy. I'm going to depart probably from my normal persona, which tends to be leaning towards pragmatism. Some people even say pessimism at times. I have no doubt I critique every aspect of everything we deal with here, because that's necessary as we go forward. But I am actually in a different mindset of fairly cautious, a fairly optimistic approach with cautiousness to it, but seeing the future as a great opportunity for home care and hospice. And most of that is triggered by the experiences that we have seen in COVID era, and how incredible the performance of healthcare in the home has been during that period of time, distinguishing itself from so many other sectors of healthcare with respect to its versatility, its capability of pivoting quickly, its ability to integrate technology into the service delivery in so many different ways, and really painting a picture for healthcare going forward that healthcare in the home has been underutilized, even under-respected, but under-recognized by people outside of the world that we live in on a day-to-day basis. That has changed during this period. So that's where, you know, I intend to go today. So let's start with it taking the first piece of the pre-COVID focus. Do you remember what that was? The pre-COVID mindset that you had this time last year? For those of you that are home health agencies, I know it was in your head. It was, how am I going to deal with this transition to the new payment model, PDGM? been working towards it for a whole year, but you know that Medicare program, it always has those surprises for you or those complications, or that it just doesn't do its job. So everybody on January 21st, 2020 that does Medicare Home Health was absorbed in PDGM. They were also concerned though about another thing. You were also concerned from a home health agency perspective about Medicare Advantage. It was growing in your location, no matter where you were, it was growing. And you knew from many years of experience, it wasn't your best business. But it was going to be a greater and greater part of your business going forward. And then if you were a hospice, you're thinking, oh my gosh, people are talking about bringing the hospice program into the panoply of Medicare Advantage benefits, the carve-in, as they called it, and a proposal to create a demonstration program to bring that in. And so you're thinking, I know my friends in home health have had nothing but complaints about Medicare Advantage, and now I'm going to have to live in that world too. And every sector within home care, be it personal care aides, home care aides, nursing therapists, workforce shortages were surfacing once again because the demographics were posing a challenge to the future of care in the home because the workforce was not growing along with what we were seeing in a population of people age 75 and above. The typical home care patient population triggers at 75. And last thing in your mind might've been competition or the consolidation in the marketplace. You know, it varies. If you're in the state of Georgia, it's different than if you were in the state of New Jersey, different than if you were in the state of California or Oregon, you know, but there was still competition that was surfacing. There was consolidation ongoing and you wondered where would you be in that marketplace? So then we move on to the next era, the early COVID era of March and June. I remember where I was the first week of March. I was in San Antonio, Texas, giving a lecture to the American Health Lawyers Association. And as we were there, the news reports were all about COVID. There was that cruise ship that they had to abandon with patients, individuals who were infected with COVID. And guess where they shipped those individuals? To a military base in San Antonio. And then while we were there in San Antonio, they let some of the people out. People who had still been infected with COVID were seen at shopping centers and hotels and getting on airplanes. So there was a chilling effect at this conference in San Antonio. And that was the pivoting that started for many of us that first week of March. Might have been earlier for those people paying attention to what was coming out of Wuhan, China, and what was being expressed by the World Health Organization, but you really started feeling it come home when that cruise ship people were suddenly everywhere, all over the place. And within the healthcare environment, the first thing that happened in that early COVID area was, where am I going to get personal protective equipment, PPE? What's the access of that? We had, you know, stockpiled up enough for what we had experienced in the previous 5 or 10 years, which was not having to have PAPRs and N95s and you know, and gloves and gowns and using them to the extent that now COVID was driving you to, and where were you going to get it? And what did we see happen? And you may have been among them, you know. You're knocking on doors at closed tattoo parlors and nail salons because they use N95s and they use gloves as well, and figured if they're closed, they may not need them. You're cutting open soda bottles to use as face shields. You're negotiating with one supplier versus another supplier. And some parties, not many home care companies were able to do this, were sending jets to China to bring back KN95s because that was about all they could acquire. Staff insecurities were setting in because they were worried about themselves and their patients. You know, with community transmission of this, they didn't know if they were bringing it into someone's home, having acquired the virus themselves, or whether they were going to get a virus by going into someone's home. So the staff insecurities were there, the patient insecurities were there, and that triggered reduced revenue. Patients were saying no to visits because they didn't want to take a risk of a community transmission into their home because many of them were effectively in a quarantine situation. And then the increased cost combined with the reduced revenue was hitting, you know, the increased cost of such things as PPE, but you were losing staff to the virus. You were getting into more recruitment challenges in order to get staff coming on board. So All of these challenges were there coming in that early COVID area, and we add one more. Everything that I previously talked about, all those pre-COVID challenges were there. It wasn't like Medicare said, oh, we're not going to continue with the PDGM model, or suddenly you had a new workforce available to you for personal care services, or that the hospice programs didn't have to start thinking about Medicare Advantage carve-in. So all of those challenges were there. So this may be giving you recollection of nightmares, of anxiety, of depression setting in, but that's what we saw in March to June. And then when we got to June, we started seeing some changes happening. The challenges were continuing. A couple things happened though. Your coping capabilities were improved. The intensity of some of the challenges diminished. Patients started accepting care again, maybe not to the same extent, but admissions increased. Excuse my typo, it should say PPE remains an issue, but the supplies were improved. And when we look at the data, what we saw was a significant decline in admissions in March, April, May, and parts of June. And then it started going back to pre-COVID levels. Actually, for the last 6-7 months now, home health and hospice admissions are at or above pre-COVID levels, even though many of the elective admissions to hospitals, you know, are still not available. Those patients, say, with joint replacement, who would find themselves going into home health services or home care services. The admission impact on hospice didn't change radically, you know, but it did change somewhat. New opportunities emerged and driven a lot by technology. Telehealth, you know, and if any of you were around in the 1990s, you probably worked for a home care provider that bought into telehealth early then, these massive machines that are probably sitting in a closet somewhere in your administrative office gathering dust. But new generations of telehealth, you know, have come many times since that point. But telehealth found a much stronger healthcare setting in home care, in hospice, in every sector of healthcare. Telehealth became a big tool that created some new opportunities. And home care really adopted the tool quickly. One of the NAC board members, he's the CEO and chairman of a very large pediatric private duty home care company, mainly doing Medicaid. He said prior to COVID, they did no telehealth visits. Within a matter of weeks, they were doing thousands of telehealth visits to be an adjunct to the in-person care that they were continuing, but reducing the risk to staff and reducing the risk to patients by combining the two. Same thing's happening with home health. We did a survey early on that showed the number of home health agencies with telehealth equipment was in the 30% range and using telehealth. It's now over 50%. So still not intense adoption of it, but I mean, we are looking at a 50% increase in adoption of telehealth services. And I would bet that if we did another survey now, because that was a June survey, we would find that it's probably closer to 75%. New opportunities coming for all types of healthcare in the home. You know, we do have to put a qualification in there. If you provide personal care services, you are not using telehealth to substitute for the bathing and transfer efforts on patients, but you might be using telehealth for purposes of supportive services, education, and answering the questions, you know, in that direct way, because the telehealth could have been this kind of telehealth, your smartphone, and you know, no big piece of equipment, because HIPAA, the privacy law on healthcare, was waived. And so you could use FaceTime as an alternative to some, you know, system that had all kinds of checks within securities on that. Also within the new opportunities that began to emerge in June and later was managed care, Medicare Advantage included, embracing home care. Many of us have probably spent the last two decades trying to convince managed care plans of the value of home care, and they continue to think of it as a cost. They didn't recognize the dynamic value, the ability to prevent hospitalizations, prevent rehospitalizations, the ability to control individuals' conditions who have chronic comorbidities that, you know, may not result in the individual's death, but could really seriously increase cost of care. If they're managed better, reduce the cost of care through the home setting. So we have seen definite improvement in Medicare Advantage's understanding of the value of home care. And then because of all the difficulties, probably better to label them tragedies that we saw happening in skilled nursing facilities and nursing homes, a benefit of sorts, a service started developing on its own. You know, we'll call it the skilled nursing facility or nursing facility at home program, not the Medicaid home and community-based waiver type programs where Medicaid has long supported deinstitutionalization of individuals. Those programs are built around high levels of personal care services supports because many of the Medicaid patients are there for custodial care in a nursing home, so they had to substitute that at home. Great, great rebalancing of Medicare long-term care and supports over the years. This was instead the population that would otherwise go into a skilled nursing facility, where Medicare coverage requirements are the person must demonstrate that they need skilled nursing or therapy services on a daily basis. And then the law goes on to say, which as a practical matter, must be provided on an inpatient basis at a skilled nursing facility. Well, the home health benefit is part-time or intermittent care in contrast to daily care. It does not provide for room and board and certainly doesn't provide enough benefits to cover personal care services for either hands-on care or protective supervision, potentially 24/7. But individuals who were so interested in staying out of a skilled nursing facility where super spreading and deaths were rampant, you know, started acquiring services to add on to their Medicare home health benefit. Put a little pin in that one because we'll get back to that concept as we move forward. And then the other new opportunities was care of COVID patients in the home setting. Now, some data that I saw just this week indicated that in the early stages of COVID, about 2% of the home health agency population had a COVID positive as a primary diagnosis. But in November and December of 2020, it rose to nearly 10% of the population. That starts becoming material in operations and revenue and staffing and everything else, but it also became one other thing. It became a rallying cry for home and community-based care where home care was able to step up, bring people to the front lines, bring care into a safer environment than an institutional care environment, an individual's own home, and to do so from a clinical perspective, very capably. So we are now looking at COVID patients when we get to the end of 2020, where the numbers of COVID patients being admitted on a monthly basis is in the neighborhood, and this is just an estimate based on some cobbling together of a combination of real statistics, real data, and some anecdotal stuff, is probably about 40,000 new admissions a month of individuals who are COVID positive patients. But think of that message going out to the rest of healthcare. Home care is capable of doing this. And that was led to hospitals sending patients home before they even saw them in the emergency room. People they saw in the emergency room also detoured to the home setting. The nursing home beds were not even available, so we gave them a place to send patients for care. So now we finish with the current, you know, up through the current time, and where are we actually today, you know, for today's environment? We've got high quality and safe COVID care, you know, the thousands upon thousands. There are many parts of the country where there are more COVID care patients in home care than there are in any other care setting. You know, that shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, there are 12 million people annually that receive some form of care in the home from a home health agency, a hospice, or a home care company. You know, many, many more than you see, you know, with a couple few million people in nursing homes and so on. You're going to likely see more of care in the home, but we've seen high quality and safe care. We have seen an expanded breadth and depth of healthcare at home in a very quick way. You know, people didn't stay within their little, what we'll call swim lanes. I'm a home health agency, I provide part-time care. They started expanding. I'm a home care company with personal care. I only do 4-hour or 8-hour shifts. I don't do 24/7 care. They're now doing 24/7. And hospice, looking at somebody who's actually on COVID, you know, as an individual who may be at end of life or certainly needs some palliative care. So expanding the breadth and depth of healthcare at home, one last element to it, technology, technology, technology. You know, and we talked about that earlier, but that breadth and depth of healthcare at home involved one final thing. Because of the technology, a greater integration with the practitioners, the physicians, the nurse practitioners, and the like, greater connections in with specialists as well, because those individuals, those practitioners, through some flexibilities permitted under Medicare and Medicaid, also went into the home on a telehealth basis. So you had telehealth services being provided to an individual while you had an in-person nurse in the home and the physician is on your smartphone communicating with you and the patient in real time. You know, just an incredible advance that there came through the technology capabilities, but only triggered by those flexibilities that were authorized by the federal government. All of that triggered a greater consumer awareness of home care, a greater recognition within the other healthcare sectors about the home care capabilities and the value. And in between that, I'll sandwich in, you know, the positive media. Now, I remember last year at this time, you know, media contacts were all about workforce primarily. But then as soon as we got into March, the media jumps into home care and they start saying, you know, what's going on in home care? What's COVID done to change home care? And they're reacting to some of the inputs that they had where staff members were saying, we don't have access to PPE. It's not safe for us to go into the home for us or anybody else. Step by step by step, that media became positive. As PPE and infection control took hand, the media started talking about how valuable home care is as well, going out to the general consumers, as well as infiltrating the brains of the people in the healthcare sectors who needed some further education about what could possibly happen there, to a point where, you know, a conversation I had with one of the national media was about how unsafe it was in home care. And less than a month later, they're talking about the heroics of care in the home and how great a service this is. And with people realizing how great it is, it should help your workforce because people say, I want to be one of those heroes. You know, so positive media attention to this, you know, including everything from the technology supports on through the heroics of those frontline workers. And even to the point of recognizing that not only are they frontline workers, but being frontline workers, just like those ICU nurses, they're getting infected and they're dying too. So really demonstrating, you know, something that triggers respect for that workforce, something which has been absent. Yeah, in healthcare, you probably have seen this. People say, oh, you went into home care because you couldn't get a job in a hospital. Well, the reality is it's a much tougher job. You have to have higher skills to be working in home care, whether you're a nurse or a home care aide, because you're out there on your own. You know, you have a lot of independent responsibilities there. And so people are realizing now that what you knew, they should know as well. So gaining in respect without a doubt, you know, that recognition of home care value in that dynamic sense by all of the other healthcare sectors. So where's that take us, you know, from today's environment? We had one last bit, you know, a little bit on the business side. All of this probably wouldn't have been possible without some of the actions that took place in Congress and in the regulatory agencies, bringing about financial stabilization. The Provider Relief Fund, $175 billion of monies that went directly to healthcare providers. If you're a Medicare or Medicaid provider, you have received some of that, unless you said, no, you didn't want it. You know, but that really helps stabilize home healthcare and hospice and Medicaid home care providers. It has still left out those home care companies that are funded through private pay only, or they might do VA or long-term care insurance, but they don't do any Medicare or Medicaid. So we're still working on that aspect of support that's needed. But all of the home care providers of certain size probably tapped into the Small Business Administration Paycheck Protection Program, a loan that will turn into a grant depending upon your performance in terms of keeping people employed. Keeping people employed in home care hasn't been hard. It's not the same as a restaurant or a bar or a department store. So you're likely to turn those into grants along the way, but they've been very, very helpful in stabilizing the healthcare sector, particularly the small business side of home care. And small business is actually a little bit bigger than you might be thinking. It's not a mom and pop shop thing. It's not a mega company either. But even the mega companies qualified for Medicare advance payments if they were a Medicare provider, home health and hospice, where they could get payment based upon a forecast of their patient volume down the line, really stabilizing cash flow, addressing some of the added cost aspects that came in. And then Congress also put a pause on the Medicare 2% sequestration. Well, 2% doesn't seem to be a lot. Put those pieces together, you know, over that period of time when the volume of cases was down, so you had serious revenue reductions, and you saw all the ingredients for stabilization. When I see those things together like that, and I look at one statistic, how many home health agencies and hospices have terminated voluntarily or otherwise from the Medicare program since the beginning of this year, beginning of 2020, and what you actually see are fewer terminations of providers in 2020 than there was in 2019 or 2018. So this clearly brought stabilization. And then a sign of some stabilization operationally, but also somewhat financially, was when HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, decided that of its 150 million rapid BinaX tests that they were gonna acquire, that home care was going to get an allocation of that. And they would get it either directly or through the health departments. Not everybody's got this, not everybody's used it. I look at that not just from the fact that, well, they're gonna give 10 million tests, that's $50 million worth of supports to home care. Instead, I look at it from another aspect of it. They recognized how important it was to include home care into that mix. That's the part that will pay dividends as we go along and talk about the forecast. So with that outlook, let's see, would you believe anything I say if I didn't say that the pressure's continuing today? You know, it's absolutely the case. I mean, we talked about a surge months ago, and now we have a surge that's probably 3x what it was back then, and it's nationwide. It might have been New York and New York City back in March and April, but it's all over the place. It is urban, it is rural, it's California, it's Florida, it's South Carolina, it's everywhere, you know, and now we have, you know, to look forward to possibly a more transmittable COVID, for some of the new ones that have been morphed into this next generation of COVID life. Home care and hospice is emerging as having a role in immunizations and therapeutics, we have a new administration that is going to be focusing in on COVID vaccination, on testing, basically stabilizing the country from a healthcare perspective. But without pointing fingers and blaming everybody, we have to admit immunizations are a chaotic circumstance today. Do we really have the supply that sometimes we say we have, or is it already gone? Where is it going when it goes? We had met with HHS and CDC numerous times over where home care fit in this. You know, they said as a matter of policy, they were going to decentralize the whole operation. Give it to the states, give it to the localities because they know best on how to do it. The CDC would come forward with a series of prioritizations on who would get immunizations and when. They would go through the FDA for both immunization clearance as well as the new therapeutics, you know, but we're going to decentralize the application of that. And that's why they ended up with giving it to hospitals, giving it to health departments, the immunizations that is, and setting up a special process for the nursing homes with a partnership between CVS, Walgreens, and HHS to focus in on bringing the immunizations and the therapeutics into the nursing homes for both staff, but primarily for residents. End result, less dosages went to the hospitals and health departments than people thought, and the hospitals used them for their own staff first. That seems to have been the case overall. We are now starting to see a thaw in that, and home care is getting more of it, but we are dealing with a second problem on immunizations. The NAC board met on Wednesday to talk about where we are relative to COVID. And we had a wide range of reports on the uptake of staff in accepting the immunizations. One very large home care company with over 30,000 employees has had 16% of its employees at this point say they're willing to be immunized. Many more of them are waiting to see. Some may not have answered at all. Whereas another home care company, and this company is operating in the Seattle area, Kirkland specifically, the Evergreen Health System, which is where so much of the COVID first exploded, they have an 80+% willingness to be vaccinated. Getting the messaging into the staff to get them to understand the value. Yes, there are pros and cons, there are risks and benefits. Personally, I see the benefits far outweighing the risk, but there is a hesitancy that's there in the general population, and there's a hesitancy in the home care population as well. So outlook is, you know, we will see immunizations more readily available. We have put forward to CDC and to HHS a two-step proposal on either direct delivery of the vaccines to home care companies capable of handling storage and transportation, but alternatively, a takeoff on what happened with the nursing homes. Make CVS and Walgreens the delivery sites of choice, allowing the home care staff to go in there at the most convenient location that'll be there. That seems to be happening, generally speaking, anyway. In my locale, on Monday, the supermarket, Giant Supermarket, which is a somewhat of a regional supermarket chain, and Walmart's will start having immunizations available for the priority groups eligible at that time. That's an improvement, bringing it to the pharmacies in that way. But we have one big issue to deal with, and this goes into the outlook. How do we take care of the 12 million people that we have as patients in the home setting who are by and large homebound, who you don't want to bring out into the community because they've been safely kept in their own homes throughout this pandemic? How do you deliver it to them? We've made it very clear to HHS that while the vaccine is free, the $55 to deliver two vaccines on a one-to-one basis in the home setting is just not going to cut it to come close to covering the gas, let alone the time of getting somebody there. We need a solution that doesn't involve going around with a bus and putting people, you know, in wheelchairs and on hospital beds into that bus to take them to their local pharmacy for an injection. So we're going to need that kind of a support for that. But the role in immunizations, you know, is an important one. It's also important outlook-wise on therapeutics, because you're not going to have everybody immunized in the short term. You're going to still have infections. How do you use the therapeutics? Home care has a significant set of resources available there with home infusion therapy capabilities. And we are in conversations with HHS about tapping into that. For the moment, they want centralized infusion, 12 people sitting in a room, because what it takes is you have to have a medical person there monitoring those individuals after the administration of therapeutics, looking for adverse reactions at least for an hour, they say. And you're not going to be able to do that on a home-to-home basis except through telehealth. You know, so if you have standing orders for, you know, some anaphylactic, whatever that might be needed. Beyond that, outlook-wise, nursing facility care has been avoided. It's going to continue to be avoided. The nursing home community is raising all of these same questions themselves. What are we going to do? You know, they have 70% bed occupancy at this point, you know, and it's not going up, it's going down. You know, how are they going to adjust to that? So in the meantime, we are seeing nursing facility staff looking for jobs in home care. We are also seeing patients shifting to home care rather than being discharged into a nursing home, assuming there's even a place to be discharged to, because many of the facilities are not accepting new admissions. PDGM for an outlook for 21 is stable. CMS has decided they're keeping the same system in place without any real interruption. The non-physician practitioner role in home care is starting to gain footing. The legislation that was part of the CARES Act did need some implementation on state levels to remove some scope of practice issues or other antiquated provisions, but that is taking hold, creating, I think, a stronger partnership between practitioners and home care providers. The telehealth expansion continuing, coming from a lot of different sources, including the physicians, the home health agencies, and the hospices. And we do would forecast an opening of the elective admissions to hospitals in the not too distant future. Continuing, let's talk Washington a little bit. The new administration, whether you watched the inauguration yesterday or not, you have to be aware, you know, that things have changed in Washington on January 20th. We have a new president, a new vice president. We have the Senate, a change of control. The majority leader is now the minority leader. The minority leader is now the majority leader in the Senate, with a 50-50 split between Democrats and Republicans, giving the tie-breaking vote to Vice President Harris. And the House of Representatives continues with the Democratic majority, albeit a bit smaller than it had been before. You know, with all of that, you're going to see every federal agency head change, and many people below that. There are thousands of positions that are vacant now that have to be filled. We do not yet know who's going to be the new administrator of Medicare and Medicaid. We don't know who's going to head up the VA. We don't know, you know, who's going to be even the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, although we have Javier Becerra nominated. Becerra, former congressman from California and former attorney general in California, is well known to us in Washington. He has long been a strong supporter of care in the home. And the least of the evidence of that is I still get a Christmas card from him, which came about because we gave political donations to him in his campaigns in years past. We only support candidates who support home care. You know, we don't try to buy them with support. We reward them with support when we know that they're going to be there. So we're looking at the new administration and the new Congress as being a pro-home care administration and pro-home care Congress. Now, that's not to say Democrats are better than Republicans. It is. We have strong supports on both sides of the aisle. I'll give one note on that. If you watched the inauguration yesterday, you probably didn't see that in the audience on that level with the new president was a senator from the state of Maine, Susan Collins, a longtime home care hero, a Republican who is going to maintain power because of that 50-50 split. She's one of those swing voters, and she's the reason why we have many of the positive home care policies that came into law, including the one permitting non-physician practitioners to certify Medicare eligibility for the home health benefit. In addition, during the campaign for presidency, now President Biden indicated his interest relative to long-term care are home care, specifically referencing a proposal for a $755 billion program for home and community-based services supports to consumers, to informal family caregivers, to paid caregivers and Medicaid, and so on. You know, I don't see that one coming out of the gate quickly in 2021. There's a lot on the administration's plate to deal with, particularly COVID, to deal with. But, you know, we're going to do everything we can to remind them that this is part of their platform that got Mr. Biden elected to be President Biden. The foundational aspects are there in Washington to really have home care take hold from a policy perspective. I mentioned the awareness and the breadth of healthcare at home having taken hold in healthcare sectors and the general public. It is virtually impossible to find a member of Congress who has not been touched by home health, hospice, or some form of home care. You know, maybe not a direct patient, many of them have been, but in terms of family members. Utilization expansion, you know, that had been triggered already under the past administration, you know, is going to continue. We do not see a change of administration changing this. CMS came out with support for expanding the hospital at home demonstration program just in the last couple of months. That will continue under the new administration. You do not see that as competition, see that as an opportunity to collaborate. One of the only two hospital home demonstration sites is Johns Hopkins Health System. The chairman of the NAC Board of Directors, Mary Myers, runs the home care division of Johns Hopkins, and she is absolutely certain that this is an opportunity for home care. The hospital's not going to come in and take your place. The hospital's going to work with you to deliver that care in the home in a hospital at home program. But think of that. Think of that. For many years, we talked about, you know, the continuum of care, where hospital down to a nursing home, down to home care, down to, you know, self-care at home, there's no up and down on this. Hospital at home means you're at that acute level of care for delivery of services. That is, you know, a light years ahead of where we were just a short time ago. We knew we could be there, but now we're seeing everybody else is saying we could be there too. Same is true with skilled nursing facility at home. We have developed a proposal that will be introduced into Congress in the near term to create an option for Medicare beneficiaries who would otherwise qualify for the skilled nursing facility benefit to go receive care at home. And is, you know, you get more details on this in the future, but it piggybacks in with the Medicare home health benefit, providing additional reimbursement for additional resources that will bring a level of care comparable to what many of the nursing home skilled nursing facility patients are receiving. Now, respect for caregivers impacts workforce availability, we've talked about, and technology as a real tool. If we have anything to look out for is, will the demand exceed the supply? So continuing on, you know, our priorities, you know, workforce, workforce, workforce. You know, we could create all these abstract entitlements to home health services or hospice care or home care services, but the only way that they get to people is to have the workforce. So we need good workforce solutions. Respect is going to be part of that. Compensation should be part of it as well. But, you know, we also have to reinforce the opportunities and the educational side and so on. PPE in all sectors remains an advocacy priority. You know, I wish that NAC could open up a factory to make PPE. We're not in that position to do so, but the new administration is committed to providing supports on American soil to create more PPE. You know, we have to stop those phony masks coming in from China. You know, the so-called KN95s that are manufactured to meet none of the specifications necessary. And we can do that in the US. Immunizations also a high priority to make sure that not only does the home care staff stay as a high priority for getting them, but that so does the patient population. Again, somewhat of another indication of the improved status of home care was that virtually all across the country, individuals who provide care in the home have been ranked as a 1A priority by both CDC and by the states over many other sectors within the population, including me. I'm in a 1C category. You know, that kind of gives away my age, but I'm fortunately in C maybe rather than B in terms of age. So in home health, the priorities, I've listed them here. That choose home, SNF alternative, getting some leverage around Medicare Advantage. We think we can, we now have data available to us to help convince Medicare Advantage that they should invest in home care rather than to consider it a cost. Rural add-on needs to be reinstated. Senator Susan Collins will be there with us on that. We need direct reimbursement for telehealth services, allowing the use of it's great, but you gotta help pay for it too. And then a few other things, the Impact Act will help transition patients from inpatient to home care settings. We have to continue to keep our eyes on the road with the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission recommending rate cuts in Medicare. We gotta go back to our defensive side, not just stay offensive, and make sure we don't get these rate cuts, because MedPAC has blinders on, I'm sorry. They just do not see where the world is. You will be seeing in 2022, an expansion of the home health value-based purchasing program. Watch for what we offer for education and support on that. This has actually been a pretty good thing in the 9 states that it's operational. If you think otherwise, please get in touch with me, because this will go into our whole advocacy efforts. But the inputs that we have from the 9 states where this has been operational is a positive, by and large. And then the review choice demonstration program happening, you know, currently in 4 states, still to be extended to 2 more, maybe expanded further than that, but this is an indication you have to make sure that you recognize oversight will continue. On the next slide, you know, the hospice priorities, you know, hospice is in a much more defensive mode, and that's because hospice has passed $20 billion in Medicare spending. It's passed into double digits in terms of at least MedPAC's margins analysis for the profitability of hospice services. And you see a wide range of patients in hospices, and MedPAC's recommending, you know, they ought to reduce the level of the annual cap. And the annual cap in our views, and we support this through some very in-depth research that we've done, will lead to discrimination against non-cancer patients going into hospice, because they're the patients who have a tendency to have less predictable, longer lengths of stays, which triggers a potential application of the cap. MedPAC's recommending a 20% reduction. That will absorb all hospices across the country pretty much. and lead to hospices trying to just be available by having to say to some patients, like a dementia patient, we think you're going to be, you know, having a lifespan of 6 months or less, but we're uncertain. So we're going to wait a little while and reassess you in a couple of months. The carve-in with the Medicare Advantage plans, absolutely lessons to be learned around home health and how that might happen. Will it work or not? The jury's not in on that one yet, but we have serious concerns about that. But some other areas we think can take some improvement around the face-to-face requirements, the use of telehealth, and how audits and oversight are being conducted. And on hospice side, don't just be wary of the claims audits, because there will be stepped up quality enforcement, survey and certification will be in more hospices more frequently, and there will be intermediate sanctions, including civil monetary penalties, something that home health and nursing homes have had for years. And then, finally, in the private duty home care side of it, we want our share of the provider relief fund. We are going to be enlisting our allies in Congress to help support us with that. But for those private pay patients, it's time we see something equivalent to the child care tax credit and having an elder care or disabled person's tax credit as well. $570 billion of value is coming from informal caregivers, family and friends, to keep people at home. But they're also having to dig into their pockets to keep their loved ones at home or keep themselves at home. It's time we say what we want to recognize the value that you've brought in that, because if they don't keep them at home, where do they go? They go into a nursing home where they're going to have repeated rehospitalizations and where they're going to possibly stay on Medicaid for many years, covered by public funds. So speaking of Medicaid, though, Medicaid is a loss leader. I remember those Kmart blue light specials, where they're going to lose 20% on everything they sell you to get you to buy something else. Well, Medicaid is taking advantage of something similar. They pay you less than your cost virtually everywhere in the country and you take those referrals in order to get the Medicare fee for service referrals. Well, it's time that everybody pays their fair share, and Medicaid should pay its fair share. Medicare shouldn't be subsidizing Medicaid. And then last but not least is there needs to be some reform around the Fair Labor Standards Act, issues of minimum wage and overtime compensation. The delivery of care in the home is not the same as working in a department store, working in a restaurant, where hours are easily managed in terms of time and attendance of work. And you're not dealing with issues of a live-in who's woken up in the middle of the night to take someone to the bathroom and now the clock is running for compensation. We need a reform that really tailors the wage protections for workers to the work circumstances that we have here. We have long had to deal with the U.S. Department of Labor. They have yet to really recognize we're not fighting better wages and overtime compensation and things to workers, because workers are precious. They're the reason why care is delivered at home. But we want something that fits within the job circumstances that we have here. So overall, and Mark, thank you. And thanks, Cindy, again, for hosting this, and appreciate the opportunity to be there with everybody. But I hope everybody got a strong sense of optimism from this hardened lawyer that I am, this intense cynic that I am, this pragmatist that I've been for many, many years. But I'll leave you with one thing before we take any questions. And that was my capability of forecasting where things are just came to mind. This week is my anniversary of coming to work for the National Association for Home Care back in 1987. It wasn't even Home Care and Hospice in the name then, although hospice work was done, but 1987, January this week is when I started working there. I came to Washington to file a lawsuit against the Medicare program. Maybe that's where my personality comes from. I'm a litigator. I sue people, and I sued Medicare many, many, many times. When we moved to Washington, my wife asked me, how long do you think we'll be there for this lawsuit? And I said, 3, maybe 4 years. Well, now we added 3 decades onto that. So my forecasting ability was not great, at least in that part of my life. But the 34 years also spells one other thing. I think we've made a lot of progress in healthcare, not NAC, but home care and hospice generally has made a lot of progress and has reached a point where care in the home is being recognized as the goal. It's not going to be easy to get to that goal, but that's the ingredient for the optimism that I offered here. This is, you know, within all the tragedy of COVID-19, the silver lining of all silver linings. Home care out of all sectors of healthcare has demonstrated a value proposition that, you know, we have been working towards to get the message across that we're not just short-term post-acute care, that we're a wide range, you know, horizontally integrated, you know, incredible versatility, incredible capabilities, and creativity that is boundless. That's why I see this is a very optimistic time. So again, Mark, thank you so much for this opportunity. I don't know if we have any questions, but my phone need a break anyway. So,
well, we do have a couple questions. So thank you very much. Very broad perspective, a lot of topics covered. One of the questions that did come up, and you talked about it a little bit at the end in terms of telehealth reimbursement for home health. There was a lot of talk in the fall about the HEAT Act, a lot of buzz and headlines. Are those two things the same? Is the HEAT Act what will get us to telehealth reimbursement in the home health? And what are kind of the next steps with the change of administration and Congress, et cetera?
Well, the HEAT Act was not passed last year. It was something that didn't actually surface as an opportunity for Congress to deal with until the fourth quarter, pretty much. So it didn't have a lot of, we didn't have a lot of confidence in getting it passed. But the HEAT Act will be reintroduced. The sponsor that we had on the Democratic House side, and then the sponsors on the Republican and Democratic side in the Senate are there with us again. Our Republican sponsor on the House side has been elevated to the Senate, actually, so that could help there. But we have plenty of other Republican supporters on the House side of it. That's our vehicle for getting towards reimbursement within the Medicare home health benefit. It's not a guarantee that if that gets passed, we will get it, but instead it removes the roadblock. The current law prohibits CMS for paying for telehealth within the home health benefit. It allows you to deliver it. It allows you to get data regarding cost and those kinds of things, but does not permit paying for it. So the legislation would remove that roadblock, but still leaves with CMS some discretion as to whether they do it and then how they would do it. And we've had to, that's been a bit of a step back from where we might have been a year or two earlier, you know, and that's come, that step back has come because CMS has said, you know, hey, you know, you can't tell us how much to pay for this. You're just coming up with numbers out of thin air. You know, there was a desire to have a visit equivalency approach, a one-to-one, but it's hard to argue that a 15-minute telehealth visit has the cost equivalency to a 45-minute in-person nursing service. So how do you get to a formula that gives you the visit equivalency calculation if you want to use that modality of reimbursement? You know, but beyond that, the issues that have raised with the fraud that surfaced in telehealth, not in home care, but physicians and other practitioners, I mean, they set up telehealth factories, I think a best way to call them, in the same parts of the country that have been subject to fraud and abuse in the past, leading to people getting arrested for that, has created some hesitancy to open a portal for more telehealth payment. That's created a bit of an obstacle. Well, we will be getting the HEAT Act reintroduced in the near term. You know, we will be doing everything, including connecting with all the CINSE people on today, you know, about being part of the advocacy effort. Grassroots matters. And do I have confidence it will be passed? I have confidence that we have a better chance of getting it passed if all of the people listening today become engaged in that advocacy effort along with us.
So in terms of giving people that opportunity to engage, is that information they'll receive through NOC, letters, emails, et cetera?
Yeah, and we flood the world with our Get Engaged kind of campaigns. And then if you go to the NOC website, you know, and you go into the advocacy policy side of it, we have a whole architecture that we get from a contractor to be able to do in 60 seconds messages pre-written, if you'd like, or you could write your own, to every member of your congressional delegation on any and all of the policy issues that we'll have. And we have it up there on the HEAT Act. We have it up there on other areas as well. It takes only a minute or two to be able to do that. And then what we need to do, we try to get everybody to recognize that their one message that went out to their two senators and their House member is very important. Get their work colleagues to do the same. For that matter, get your neighbors and friends to send the messages too. The noise truly does matter. But anybody who doesn't know about when we trigger a campaign is probably needs to start reading messages that are coming in, because if anything, we over-message rather than under-message.
All right, excellent.
If you don't work it through the NAC website, state home care associations often have similar platforms to send the messaging, and we work in strong partnership with the states.
That's great. It's good to hear the channels to make sure the voice is heard. Let me highlight one other question that came through, I think, in our remaining time. You talked a number of times around SNF at home, hospital at home. You mentioned specifically it as an opportunity for cooperation with other providers as opposed to competition. Is there resources available through NAC or other ways that you suggest for people to think about how to take the idea and actually start the actual action of that cooperation or collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, we do have resources. I mean, if they look back at a number of our conferences, the programs, you know, that were recorded and such, you know, we'll have a variety of things. We don't have anything on SNF at home or hospital at home yet because these are such new things, but we are developing those aspects of it. But some of that stuff is going to be developed out of whole cloth because, you know, people aren't running a SNF at home program today that fits within the Medicare benefit. They may be piecing together personal care from one source and so on. So we'll be developing those things. In the end, it's going to take initiative requirement by the companies themselves, you know, because these are relationships on a local level, but they could start building or reinforcing the ones that they have now already, you know, and the common denominator everywhere is physicians. And so having relationships there, and physicians are flocking to ACOs, so that's a place to consider. But hospitals are looking to be there in the future too, and are looking for partners with good ideas on that. So we'll be getting more information out, particularly on the hospital at home. Our chairman of the board, I mentioned to you, you know, working with us to really give a, you know, kind of a roadmap on how to make this work. The key factor, and this is the one thing, you know, that, you know, maybe people need an extra cup of coffee to get there, I don't know, or a can of soda in the morning that's highly caffeinated, or one of those other energy drinks, but you got to spend part of your time on the business as usual, but you have to also spend part of your time on that new business opportunity, the future of care in the home. Just as you budget monies for various things, you got to budget time and money to be able to do that and to build those relationships. And those relationships, you know, are probably going to start more from the home care side than they are from the physician or the hospital side. Don't sit by the phone waiting for somebody to call saying, hey, I'm thinking about a hospital to home care program. Instead, go to them and say, have you looked at a hospital home care program? Easier said than done from my end of it, but that's how these things really end up happening, is that relationship side of it.
No, that's great advice. So time to take the initiative.
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much. A wealth of information today. Really appreciate your time. Just a couple closing remarks. A word about Synzi for people who may not be aware. Synzi is a technology company. We offer a secure integrated communication platform focused especially in the post-acute space. So enabling the conversations for care delivery virtually and remotely, not necessarily requiring the waivers that are in place right now. So everything is secure and designed to meet all HIPAA requirements. A number of different ways that you can use Synzi to engage patients, from proactive scheduled education around conditions, symptom awareness, reminders. Certainly the concept of video calls is included. Also secure messaging, remote patient monitoring, and self-reporting via assessments and other data collection aspects. So the idea for CINSE is to enable home care and other post-acute providers to deliver that care, supplement the in-home visits, and make sure that you've got great continuity across the care team and especially with the patient. So again, thank you very much. Last bit of housekeeping is I just want to highlight that next month's session is going to be with Bud Langham, Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer at Encompass Health. And he's going to be speaking with us about the future home health patient and provide some additional perspectives on what home health care looks like post-COVID and the going into the remainder of 21. That session will be on February 25th.